wants to know why, when you were discussing the Voyager, why the bit rate had to be slowed down. Why, if it's traveling on that wave, why do we have to slow down the bit rate to get through? Maybe you could handle that for him, Dick. KC2WGB, back to you.
It turns out that not many people realize this one, and that is if someone asks you the question, what is the weakest possible signal I can receive with a radio system? Believe it or not, there is no exact answer. The most extreme example I know of is the radiometry receiver used by a radio telescope. Let me drop. In the case of a radio telescope, a really good radio telescope could listen to the noise coming out of a star, where as you wave the antenna at the star, and you pick up a certain amount of signal, noise from the star, and then wave the antenna into cold space alongside of that star, you might have a signal so weak that it changes the apparent temperature, and there's a direct relationship between temperature and signal strength, it might change the exact temperature of your receiver by 1 degree Kelvin. A good radio telescope has no trouble listening to 1 degree Kelvin. Well, it's not demodulating that signal, it's just measuring the presence of a signal, that there's a louder amount of noise, a very, very weak noise, in one direction or another. However, the amount of noise your receiver gets is a function of its bandwidth, the final bandwidth of the receiver. When you modulate, in the case of amplitude modulation or FM modulation, narrowband FM, if I'm whistling into the microphone with a 1 kilohertz frequency, with amplitude modulation, there would be a upper sideband, 1 kc above the carrier, a lower sideband, 1 kc below the carrier. The total bandwidth of the signal I'm transmitting is 2 kilohertz wide. And so the receiver you're using would have to be 2 kilohertz wide to completely receive that signal. If I now whistled at 100 hertz instead of 1 kilohertz, the upper sideband would be 100 hertz away, the lower sideband be 100 hertz away to the bottom, and therefore I'd be at 200 hertz bandwidth. I could make the receiver 200 hertz wide instead of 2 kilohertz wide and get proper reception of that particular signal. So if you're willing to slow down the bit rate of the signal by definition will be more narrowband. If the signal is more narrowband, let me drop. If the signal is more narrowband, then you're able to use a more narrowband receiver. The more narrowband receiver receives less noise. See, Mother Nature is putting a lot of noise out there across all of space, or because of the noise figure of your receiver front end, the first transistor. There's always electronic noise of your equipment, and there's atmospheric noise and let's call it the noise of the environment, noise of the universe. All of those noises get combined together, and noise is a thoroughly broadband signal. It goes everywhere, DC to light, across the whole frequency region. The signal you're listening to has to have a certain strength to come above that noise for you to receive it. Okay? If your receiver can be made more narrowband, you receive less of that noise. Whether the noise is coming from your electronics or coming from space, it doesn't matter. The more narrowband you make the receiver, the less noise it receives. Half the receiver bandwidth, you get half the amount of noise. It's a direct relationship. But if your particular signal has the right characteristics that it can fit into that more narrowband receiver, your IF strip is usually where the narrowband filter is located, then you will have sufficient signal-to-noise ratio. Another way of looking at it is that you could take a very weak signal being displayed on the screen of a spectrum analyzer. Let me drop.
Good morning. Good
morning.
Good morning. Good morning.
This is no stranger to the family. This is my part-time here hanging out.
Looks like we're going to have a little bit of a timeout problem here. I could take a very narrow band signal. I could take a very weak signal, display it on the screen of a spectrum analyzer. And you're going to see a little bit of a bump in the middle of the screen. If I take the spectrum analyzer's resolution bandwidth, which maybe was 1 megacycle, and I cut it down to 100 kilohertz, or down to 10 kilohertz, you'll see the noise across the bottom of the screen of the spectrum analyzer get lower.
Repeater, time out.
You will see the noise on the spectrum analyzer go lower, but the signal doesn't change. A properly calibrated spectrum analyzer will display a signal as a certain number of centimeters of deflection on the screen, and that does not change when you're using the spectrum analyzer correctly. But as you go to more and more narrow filters, the noise power displayed goes to lower and lower numbers, therefore the signal sits more and more decibels above that noise. So in the case of Voyager, because it is a signal coming from something like 8 billion miles, more than three times the distance to Pluto, by the time the signal gets to us, it's very, very weak. And so NASA had properly planned, Mr. Ed Stone, the main engineering manager of that project, had properly planned that thing so that he had the ability to command it to transmit the bits of information at a slower rate. Slower rate of bits really means that it's like me whistling at 100 hertz instead of 100 kilohertz. The signal is more narrowband. And so the actual receiver bandwidth that NASA is using is in the vicinity of 150 hertz, extremely narrowband receiver, in order to get that very weak signal. Yes, the bit rate is a slow number, but you can still keep talking to it, and they intend to keep talking to it in the year 2025. Let me speak with John. Let's see if you can get through this noise. I think you will be. KC2 WGB, K2RIW in the TechNet.
KC2 WGB, how copy, Dick?
Good copy, John. Please proceed.
Okay, very good. Yeah, that's something very few people were aware of or are aware of, and it's a...
Repeater, time out. Repeater, time out. Cancel.
At least have a little better understanding. Okay, I'll let it drop. And by the way, I do have a message for N2EO, which I can pass on at the end of the net. Someone just in the chat room sent me some information. So that'll be good for Rich's telescope. I'll let it drop.
We had good copy of all of that, John. And so you can go on to the next one, or give Rich the information you just got from the chat room. It's your choice. KC2WGB, K2RIW in the TechNet. Looks like we're going to be getting some nice jamming tonight. By the way, anybody hearing the jamming, the signal that shouldn't be there, please go to the reverse mode, in other words, listen to 146.25, and do tell us what you hear, how strong, where you were located, and what time did you hear it, and report that to rfi@limarc.org. rfi@limarc.org. Tell us what you heard, how strong it was on the input frequency. Go ahead, John. KC2WGB, K2RIW.
Pretty good, Dick. N2EO, Rich, can you copy me? Do you understand?
Still, John, Roger, Roger.
Okay, got a pencil, paper?
No, I don't, John. I'm weighing down. You know the situation here. I can't get to a pen and paper, but whatever.
Okay, N2SLW just sent me a little message in the chat room, and he has a website, OptCorp, one word, OptCorp, .com, OptCorp.com. Says it's a good online retailer with a lot of information. You may want to check that out.
Okay, John, I'm not happy with that.
We'll be able to send that information to you more often, Rich, so don't worry. You got it, John. KC2WGB, K2RIW.
Okay, yes, I copied it down, so maybe later on or tomorrow I can retransmit it if you didn't get it all. All right. C2WGB. All right, this gentleman has a question on a dipole antenna, which happens to be horizontal. He has a lamp with a little coil on it. As he brings it out and slides it along this antenna, he can get it to light.
it lighting at the voltage position or the current position, or is it lighting at... Maybe you could help out with that. KC2WGB, back to you, Dick.
Yeah, it turns out that a dipole, an ordinary half-wave dipole, resonant at your particular frequency, has a very peculiar voltage and current distribution. The voltage is very high at the ends. The voltage is very low at the center. The current is very high at the center. The current is very low at the ends. If it's a neon bulb you're using, a neon bulb lights primarily due to local voltage, not current, most of the time, voltage, because the end has a much higher voltage. And let me give an example. Let's assume now that my 70 ohm impedance dipole, that's the usual impedance of a dipole in free space, 70 ohms, if I'm putting 70 watts into it on a 70 ohm transmission line, that would be 70 volts at 1 ampere. So you're putting 70 volts at 1 ampere into the dipole. If my dipole had a Q of 10, I think the Q is really higher than that, but I'm rounding off the numbers to make the mathematics simple. If the dipole had a Q of 10, that means that somewhere on that dipole, the voltage is 10 times higher than what your transmission line gave you. In my example, 72 volts is the amount of voltage on a 70 ohm transmission line with 70 watts going into it, times 10 is 720. There would be 720 volts of difference between the right-hand tip and the left-hand tip of the dipole. More than enough voltage in this example to light up a neon bulb held in your fingers, held in that area. There are other kinds of sensing devices you can use, like a very small loop of wire on the end of a piece of coax cable, maybe a loop that's only a quarter inch in diameter, so to speak. And now, into the right kind of a receiver, that's a kind of a current sniffer, and if you move that along the dipole, you'll find out you get the maximum response in the center, where it's got maximum current. And oh, by the way, the current would be 10 times higher. Your transmission line is giving you...
Repeater, timeout.
In my example, the transmission line is giving you 70 volts at 1 ampere. However, in this example, the dipole will have 10 amperes of current flowing in the center. It's crazy, but it does do that. And there's an article I had that's on Bernie's Dropbox, K2 Yankee Asker. His Dropbox, it's Bernie at huntfamily.org, or is it huntfamily.com? Anyhow, you sign up at that particular Dropbox, you'll see an article I've got there explaining the voltages and currents you get across a dipole. The current is at least 10 times higher in the center than the current launched into the dipole by way of the transmission line. The voltage at the tips is at least 10 times higher than the voltage that's launched by your transmission line in that dipole. So a dipole, what's really going on is that this crazy distribution is a fact of the example of that the energy you launch into the dipole. You'd like to believe that your transmission line puts energy into the dipole, and you'd like to believe that dipole energy just simply jumps into space. Absolutely not. Can I drop? It turns out the energy your transmission line launches into the dipole bounces back and forth at least 10 times before it gets radiated. That's what the Q of 10 really means. And so what we call resonance is to have just the right electrical length of the dipole so that the energy bounces back and forth 10 times, stays in step, stays coherent with itself, so to speak. That's what resonance really means. So, because the energy has to bounce back and forth, there's a very significant standing wave on that dipole, and that standing wave shows up here, higher voltage at the tips and higher current at the center. Back to you, John. KC2WGB.
Okay, let's see if I can get through better this way. antenna around in the other direction so I give you guys a little bit more signal. The, I'll be there in a minute when the antenna gets into the right direction. Turns out that the grain of wheat that you're talking about, that kind of a light bulb, is a, not a neon bulb, if I understand correctly. That's really a more conventional incandescent light bulb. As such, depending on what kind of a pickup wire or loop or whatever you have on it, it might be more sensitive to current than it is to voltage. And let me do a little bit more testing here to see if I can get a slightly stronger signal. Ah, yes. There's the right place. As you can tell, I'm rotating a Yagi toward the other repeater. The grain of wheat, I think, is a conventional incandescent light bulb. And if you've got a small loop of wire coming off the end of that grain of wheat, and you hold it with various orientations near the center of the dipole, it will be more of a current sensor. So if it's an incandescent light bulb, properly set up, it will be a current sensor. If it's a neon bulb like an NE2, it's primarily a voltage sensor. And so by using various kinds of sensors, you will be able to plot what is the voltage distribution and current distribution across that dipole. Very educational thing to do. KC2 WGB, K2RIW in the TechNet. John, are you there? KC2 WGB, K2RIW. You may have to go to the other frequency because of what's going on here. Over to you, John, K2RIW.
WGB, copy now, Dick.
Beautiful copy. Please proceed.
Okay, my comment was these gentlemen are very innovative and they've come up with a lot of diagnostic simple tools to discover what's going on with these antennas. Okay, that's about it from the mailbag. Let's go over to Paul and see if he can get through. KC2 WGB.
Very fine, John. Paul? You're probably going to have to use the Eastern input and what's NASA been doing. And every time I go to the right NASA website where they tell me what Voyager is doing and you see those numbers running up as it moves further and further away from the sun. And by the way, right now, when you look at the numbers and you look at the distance between Voyager and Earth, you see the number is going down. Whereas the distance between Sun and Voyager, the number is going up. And if anybody asks the question, how come? The answer is the Earth moves at, I think it's 19 miles per second in its orbit around the Sun. So right now the Earth is moving in the direction toward Voyager, and it's moving a little bit faster than Voyager is moving right now. That's why the numbers are going down when it comes to distance between Earth and Voyager, whereas Voyager is moving away from the Sun, and so therefore those numbers are going upward. WS2N with the SpaceNet. K2RIW. Give me a brief transmission to make sure you're coming through okay tonight, Paul. WS2N, K2RIW.
This is WS2N, and did you notice numbers were going down on Voyager 1, and they were still going up on Voyager 2? Brief transmission.
You sound beautiful, and yes, that's because they're going off into two separate directions. So the Earth is moving in the direction toward Voyager number 1, and not necessarily toward Voyager number 2. So therefore the numbers move in different rates. At first I thought I was seeing an error until I realized that they are telling the truth. Go ahead, Paul. You sound good.
Okay, yeah, I think on that site, I think they, if you click around, they'll tell you that could happen. March 1st, so less than a month away, and that'll bring in more supplies, probably close to 4,000 pounds of supplies to the space station. But I think we're up to almost 6,000 each time they went.
Packages, and
then they inject water into it. And my guess is John Glenn did not do this. He was so busy on his short of five-hour trip. Just three orbits. He had a lot of things on his mind. I mean, it's true he did have a tube of applesauce and squeeze that down his throat, make sure that would work. That was part of the experiments. Nobody ever tried that before. They wanted to see if that was possible. But he had his hands full. Came up right in the middle of the mission. They thought the heat shield had come loose, and the telemetry went back to Houston, and what they saw was a loose heat shield, and they got the bright idea to leave the retro rockets on. They had these three retro rockets in the back of Mercury, and they would fire to slow the spacecraft down, and then the thing would deorbit. But before it deorbits, the Mercury missions were configured that they would jettison the retro rockets, and that a heat shield would be the piece that would be hitting the atmosphere. They said, let's leave the retro rockets on and let them burn up in the atmosphere. At least we'll know that, you know, the retro rockets will be holding. If we don't let them go, there's big straps and everything, that will hold at least the heat shield on. We'll go that way. And they did it. And they had a lot of sparks coming off. And any photography that was taken, they knew that this was really a dramatic entry with the sparks from the retro rockets burning up. But he had his hands full with this. He had to control the spacecraft itself. Not automatically. Had to control the spacecraft by himself, not automatically. And my guess is he wouldn't have had time to do much else in this 5-hour time span. Because the retro wire rockets were still on, when he started going into the atmosphere, he had a lot of extra control on that as well. And maneuvering to get into position beforehand, he used up a lot of fuel. So he had his hands full. And that was, when you think about this, 54 years. What is it? We're in 2014 now. 54 years ago when he went up. And this month, too, I think it was the 20th of February, for John Glenn. But looking through some of my old books, I came across another story that we talked about on the net. And we had a discussion about one of the shuttles. I couldn't remember which one at the time, to rescue a satellite. Now, they did this. Different repairs. They repaired in the space, released them back to orbit. They would bring some back to Earth. But there was one that we talked about that they had to put another motor on, another rocket on the bottom of it, first time that was ever done, to send the satellite back to to geosynchronous orbit. It was an Intel set that never made it to geosynchronous orbit. So, I think I had mentioned it was the first time they ever had a DBA with three astronauts standing outside the spacecraft. And a question came up that, you know, that would have been unsafe, probably didn't happen, this and that. I don't remember, who came back with it. You might have Dick or maybe Mel or something at the time. It's quite a few years ago. Well, in this book, it's called Space Flight. I had come across this. I'm looking for things with Tang. And sure enough, they had a picture of the STS 49 back in 1992. the three astronauts standing outside on the cargo bay, pulling in this satellite, and sure enough, they hooked up this Power G kick motor, and off it went, and they put it into a geosynchronous orbit. Took them two spacewalks to do that, actually three spacewalks. Two of them they did try with two men, and then the third one was a success when they sent three guys out. And in fact, after that, they had another spacewalk that they did, a planned spacewalk for testing building of the International Space Station. At the time, they were calling it Freedom. As we know, it never got that name. And that's pretty much all I had, Dick. Any questions on this, or let me drop it. This is WS2N. Any questions, you can email me at spacenetreport@gmail.com. Dick, any questions? Voyager, satellite repair, or any of the above, or anything else. We're here, WS2N. No, we're not watching the Super Bowl tonight.
3-9-4. You're one of the very few people that are not watching the Super Bowl. And the last I know, the Seahawks were winning, but that was a long time ago. In the case of John Glenn in Mercury 7, I think it was called, but I'm not sure, where they worried about the heat shield disconnecting and left the retro rockets on. What's complicated about that is that, as I see it, the retro rockets stuck behind the heat shield a certain distance back. As such, the aerodynamics are changed in such a way, becoming dangerously close to the way, to the point where the spacecraft is not stable running heat shield first. It might want to flip around backwards, and if it ever did flip around backwards, nose foist, if at the pointy side first, then it would burn up, and John Glenn would not have survived. So I wonder if he had to do some extra steering to make sure that it stayed with proper orientation with all the extra aerodynamics of the retro rockets still connected behind the heat shield. That's question number one, Paul. And when it comes to the space shuttle that recovered a geosynchronous satellite that did not fire its apogee kick motor, let me drop. I think it was an Indian satellite from the country India, which the apogee kick motor didn't work correctly, and they attached a brand new apogee kick motor. That's the motor that takes you from parking orbit just above the Earth and gets you into geosynchronous orbit, 22,300 miles up, as opposed to only a couple of hundred miles up. And I don't think there was a space shuttle mission in which they went and captured a major satellite and brought it back home. But you might have an opinion on that one. And if they did, I wonder if they were worried in those days about the extra heat load it would put on the heat shield, on the thermal tiles on the leading edge of the shuttle. You bring home extra mass, and that's a lot of extra energy you have to dissipate as you hit the atmosphere and slow down. Over to you, Paul. WS2N, KQRIW in the TechNet.
Okay, you're right. 100% about extra steering for John Glenn. In fact, that was in the article. The NASA article, so I trust them. They had quite a deal on their hands with the worrying about that. But, you know, he was the super-duper pilot, you know. He knew those controls inside and out, and he had no problem. But he did have a lot of extra steering going on because the aerodynamics, like you said, were compromised. So, and, yeah, in regard to the Endeavour flight that went up to get the... this particular satellite I was talking about, that was Intelsat. So it's my guess that was an American Westinghouse or something satellite. The other ones, yeah, there was Indian ones. There was quite a few different flights that were involved with doing this type of thing. Yeah, the Challenger went up and captured a Solar Max flight. That was really cool. But before doing that, they would release the satellite. They'd bring one up with them. They captured the Solar Max. They repaired it, sent it out. But they bought a couple back. They bought Westar 6 back and Papalot B-2. That's the one. That was an Indian one. They did bring those two back in one flight. And they thought nothing of this. There was a project called the Long Duration Exposure Facility, LDEF. And it was the whole size of the cargo bay. Drop it. The LDEF, Long Duration Exposure Facility, was launched by Columbia. Oh. Early in the program, and it was only designed to stay up there for a year and a half or so, and that was it. And then once Challenger happened, they couldn't bring it back, so it stayed up there for 5 years before they eventually went up and got this thing and brought it back. The idea of the LDEF was to see what the space environment, you know, radiation, cosmic rays, little meteorites, sun exposure, ultraviolet, you know, they had on the outside of this thing, cylinder contraption that they sent up there, it was quite heavy, was all kinds of materials, you know, these little 4x4 plate materials covered the whole thing, and each one was made of a different substance. And this was all tied into equipment on the inside, the monitor, everything. But their goal was to leave it out there for a year and a half and bring it back. And they did, finally. So they did bring satellites back. Dick, back to you.
I'm Mason. Can you
amazing. Because that does create an extra heat load, as I see it, Paul. So they did bring things back. And in those days, we didn't worry about the heat load of the shields until we had a damaged one on the Challenger. Columbia, a very famous flight with a very dramatic failure mode. So at least two satellites were brought back home, as well as the LDEF. And I do remember a number of the flights with the Mercury and Gemini, Mercury in particular. We weren't quite sure whether or not the return was going to be successful because of the significant blackout time when, as you enter the atmosphere, you create this plasma of conductive material around the satellite. The heated air becomes a plasma, and as such, the radio signal they had in those days, picked up by downrange trackers, would go below threshold, and so until they almost deploying the parachute, you had a great big long period of time in which there was no communication with the returning satellite and astronaut. And so I do remember there were times when for like 20 solid minutes you weren't sure whether or not he was still there, if you know what I mean. I wonder if you remember some of those episodes of Paul. WS2N, K2RIW.
Oh, sure. Every flight had a blackout period, including the shuttle, and including the future Orion. All the spacecraft that are coming back. The telemetry from Dragon, from the commercial flight, a couple of minutes are lost on the way back. So, and they always call it ionized. They're calling it plasma. I wonder what the difference would be. They always refer to it as being ionized. It's ionized. You can't get a signal in or out. But I guess what's happening to the atmosphere, I guess that would be a plasma effect. Back to you, Dick.
One everything got properly reset. It turns out that ionized and plasma are the same thing, Paul. What a plasma is a material, usually in gaseous form, but not necessarily, which is heated to such a degree that the electrons and nucleus of atoms become separated. That's what ionized means. So you've got separate free-floating electrons and separate free-floating positively charged particles. That is what ionized means. That's what a plasma is. So every spark... every spark of your spark plug is a plasma. I think whether or not a flame coming out of a blowtorch is a plasma, I'm not sure. But the ionized material that you get on reentry is a plasma. It's a conductive material. It's a, I mean, Earth is a conductive material. You put a radio transmitter 50 feet below the surface of the Earth and cover it up, and your amount of ability to transmit a signal is going to be cut down by 1,000 to 1, 10,000 to 1. You know, that would be 30 dB or 40 dB attenuation, because it's in a conductive substance. Well, plasma is a conductive substance. Now that we use the Tejas satellites, I think the beginning of the reentry of, say, for instance, the space shuttle, I think for a period of time you still have communication up to Tejas, even though you might not have communication back down to the ground. But I guess you're saying, even with Tejas, there's still a significant blackout period. Is that true, Paul? WS2N, T2RIW?
Yes, oh yes. With all the shuttles and every one of them, you have the blackout period. That ionization, they can't get any past it. So, I guess if the ionization was going out in a perfect cone, that would be good. Then you could transmit up to Tejas. Don't forget the shuttle bays are closed. That knocks out all their directional antennas. Even if that was possible, the cargo doors are closed. So that's the end of that. And then, by the way, it's Friendship 7, but Mercury 6. This whole complicated scheme of what goes on there. We have that patch actually hanging on my wall, along with the stamp. Back then they used to take a lot of different events. So I kept a couple of stamps that, you know, for, in this case, the first man to go around. Interesting guy, John Glenn. I guess he's over 90 years old now. Eventually went up again, 98, on this shuttle for about a week or so. He finally got his second ride. Real cool guy.
So that was Friendship 7, where he had to accurately steer it on the way home because of the retro rockets being left on. And a dangerous mission. So, as you're saying it now, the high-gain antenna, the KU-band high-gain antenna that comes out of the cargo bay of the shuttle, that gives you a high-speed data link up to the Tejas satellite, which then relays it back down to the ground. And I'm pretty sure they've got an omnidirectional antenna for the KU-band link that's operational with the cargo bay closed. But it's at a much lower gain, therefore a much lower data rate. So even that one gives them a blackout, is what I think you're saying. And was there an experiment that you remember, Paul, where they tried squirting water out of the leading edge or something like that to see if they could get some correction of the ionization sheath that gives you the blackout? Were there any attempts to try to talk through the blackout by trying to neutralize some of the ionization? I vaguely remember there was an experiment, which I'm guessing didn't work out very well, because I don't think they did it very often. WS2S, K2LIW.
I don't remember anything like that, Dick. Don't ring a bell, so. No, no, it doesn't. But if you go back and listen, like, to the recordings, even on STS-107, and that's the Columbia, the one that burned up, coming back after a 15-day flight. By the way, that did not go to the International Space Station. That was a regular science mission. That was a 23-degree inclination. That wasn't even on a, you know, nothing to do with the space station. And I wish it would have, because they would have noticed. It was something's wrong with those panels, you know. I mean, somebody would have seen something, I think. Although they didn't do the POS pictures at the time, I think something would have showed up. They would have seen something. That mission, for instance, when you listen to it, they have their blackout period, and they make their call up to it. They'll say Columbia or Houston, and then all of a sudden the time went by and drop it. I remember Miles O'Brien, he was the reporter for CNN at the time. They laid him off and all his technical staff. They just wanted to do politics on CNN now. But back then it was good. And he was saying, you know, it's a 30 seconds fast. They're looking at the, you know, you saw the control room. I was watching this live at the time. And another 20 seconds went by, and he just made a report that this is ominous. Never forget that. And then the time just ticked by. They had reports of the spacecraft breaking up. They saw the. They were giving reports that everything was getting hotter and hotter. You know, they have thermocouples all over the place. They know the mist is. They know the temperatures of everything. They knew there was a problem. I can't believe I keep timing this thing out. You got all that, Dick. I keep timing out. WS 2.
Paul, you did not time out. Not to worry. You did not time out. Interesting material. So, you did see the blackout for quite a period of time on Columbia. And the blackout never did that go away, so to speak. I went and got the device that's sold by Barnes & Noble. If Rich is listening, I called it an astrolabe. They don't call it that. It is 16 inches in diameter. It shows you it's one of these plastic color rotatable things which you dial in the month and the hour. And Barnes & Noble calls it Guide to the Stars. Guide to the Stars in the Northern Hemisphere. Obviously, they make a version for Australia, and they make a version for where we live, the Northern Hemisphere. This one says it operates from 30 degrees to 60 degrees north latitude. So that's the main thing that the Rich is looking for, Guide to the Stars. I like having this physical object to know what you're going to be able to see when, and you can easily dial in by just rotating it. What am I going to see 2 months from now, so to speak? Or what am I going to see at 1 o'clock in the morning versus 9 o'clock at night? And you get a very rapid answer. And because it's 16 inches in diameter, you're getting a nice high resolution answer, so to speak, as opposed to what you would see on your iPhone. Go to the right website or the right application, you're going to see a picture of the sky, but it's on a very tiny screen. You're not going to get as much information as you can out of the
9:57 p.m. The time is 9:57 p.m.
Teacher, I...
Eric is available, or anyone else who has D-Star knowledge.
So we have anybody on frequency who has got some experience with D-Star, give me a call that is right now, K2LIW in the TechNet.
Unstable, but temporary in positive or negative